This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting at Focused Community Strategies and the host for Place Matters. This podcast introduction is being recorded on the very day of the 70th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision to affirm that school segregation is indeed unconstitutional. Though there have been eras of progress towards integration, our schools are more segregated today than they were in the late 60s. And residential segregation also persists. Though our cities as a whole are increasingly diverse, at a neighborhood level, studies are showing that we have seen an increase in segregation in the last 40 years. A common explanation for this is the theory of natural sorting. People are simply choosing to live near people who are like them, politically, racially, economically. And though there is plenty of truth to the freedom of choice for people to live where and among whom they so desire, personal preference is not a strong enough force to shape a nationwide phenomenon of deeply entrenched residential segregation that is also defined by residential inequality. So, how do we account for this? Joining me today to help us understand why we are where we are is Dr. Jessica Truenstein, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. Professor Truenstein studies the process and quality of representation in American democracy, focusing on the ways in which formal and informal local political institutions generate inequalities. She has served as a consultant for the U.S. Department of Justice, city governments, and various community organizations, and serves on numerous editorial and foundation boards. Listen in as we talk about her most recent book, Segregation by Design: Local Politics and Inequality in American Cities.
Dr. Truenstein, thank you so much for making time to be a part of Place Matters today. I've benefited so much from your research, from your book, and I'm excited to expose our listeners to your work, if they're not already familiar, and just to talk through this idea of our neighborhoods and our cities being segregated by design. So thank you for making time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, awesome. Well, before we get into the actual research, I'm always curious what leads people to want to invest their personal and professional interest in this line of work. So what influenced or motivated you to want to focus on this type of work?
Well, it started with a puzzle. I was sort of interested in understanding why some neighborhoods seem to have good access to public goods and others did not. Mm-hmm. I was living in New Jersey at the time, and my commute took me through a little bit of Trenton on my way to the town of Princeton. And it's impossible to ignore the fact that when it snows, the Trenton roads would be less likely to be plowed than the Princeton roads would. And so I got interested in understanding why the capacity of some communities was different than others. And I began to look for research in political science that would help me understand this. And I ran into a lot of sort of dead ends, and I couldn't figure out the answer. And eventually I settled on this idea that sort of where you live determines the access to government resources that you have, and which of course then led me to try to figure out why some people live in certain places and other people live in different kinds of places and who has access to those different kinds of neighborhoods. And sort of pretty quickly I began to understand that this is a problem of segregation. So I thought, okay, well, I'll study segregation. I'll figure out how we got there and how that produces these inequalities in access to government resources. And I'll go all the way back to the 1960s. I thought, I'm going to do this historical research and I'm going to trace, you know, development over time, because probably like most people, I thought sort of right before the civil rights era would lead me to sort of understand patterns in American history. So I got all the way back to the 1960s, and almost immediately I figured out that what I could see on the ground was really connected to what had been there in the 1950s. So I went back to the 1950s and it on. And I just, it became obvious to me that these patterns that I was finding in the, you know, 2010s were really connected to like 100 years before. And so I thought, okay, I just got to start at the beginning. How early can I go? Where can I begin this, this story? And so I settled on 1890 because that was the earliest census data that I could get in any sort of regular way. And it was clearly before the sort of mass urbanization of the United States. So I thought, I'll just pick this early date and I'll try to figure out what is happening in cities and the geography of cities starting there. And that's how it started. And that's why it took me 10 years to write this book.
Well, thank you for the labor in it. I have, of course, I'm exaggerating, but I feel like I wrote more in your book than was written in the book. There's just, it was just so, you know, our work is really, one, as practitioner, we work in the neighborhoods that have been impacted negatively by all of these forces. But we also do training consulting with other organizations who are also working in neighborhoods impacted by these forces. And so like, it's one thing to kind of get it because you see it and you work in it every day. It's another thing to be able to articulate and advocate more broadly. Like, this is not just one neighborhood in Atlanta or an occasional neighborhood in an occasional city that, to your point, I mean, from the foundation of urbanization, this is where we are. And even just your title using the word design, like I was like, I'm going to read it just because that word is there, because that is that's so significant, where there's so much of this goes by this idea of like, oh, we just kind of choose to be where we want to be. So as you were unpacking that entire history, other than like census data or just historical records, what were some of your tools or methods as you're kind of spending a decade researching this? What are the kinds of things you were doing to really unpack and make plain this pattern that has existed for so long?
The first thing that so this is my pattern in all the big projects that I've done. I end up writing a piece of it that's in the middle somewhere. And then I sort of have to figure out what's on either end of those parts. And so I started with this piece that made sense to me from a political science standpoint, which is connecting segregation patterns to public goods provision. And that's where I started, which is actually the middle of the book. And I went backwards in time to understand the historical setup. And that led me to trying to understand the origins of planning and zoning, which is not really something that is covered in political science very well. So this required learning a lot from other disciplines that have spent much more time researching these histories. And what I thought I was going to do was just sort of cite secondary sources that say, you know, this is how segregation gets created. And then I was going to move on with my political science-y standpoint. But what it turned out to be was a lot of the history that I was finding was oriented around other kinds of goals that cities were trying to achieve using planning. And only very rarely did race or class appear in the writing that I was finding. And, you know, probably that's partially a limitation of sort of my lack of knowledge of other fields. But what I ended up doing was going back to the primary source materials. So reading articles and publications that were written by the very earliest planners, people who were part of the City Beautiful movement, people who were thinking about the design of cities back in the early 1900s. And it was there that I found little clues about sort of what might have motivated some of these decisions. And that's, so it, you know, for me, it was a process of sort of chasing crumbs, right? Somebody, I would find a line in some article, and then I would try to figure out where that person was connected, who they were talking to, who their audience was, and sort of building out this network of sources from there in order to build the story. And then I wrote the theory that this was segregation by design, sort of, you know, in my office by myself. Nobody had ever, I wasn't really talking with people. And then when I finished it, I thought, oh geez, I need to make sure that this is not crazy. And so I started sending it around to my friends and said, you know, asking for feedback and help in sort of refining the argument. And I got a lot of help. That's one of the amazing things about being an academic is that there are people I can talk to from across fields and within my discipline who don't study cities. And I had a community of people helping me understand the story that I was trying to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as a non-academic and practitioner myself, I find myself sitting by myself in a coffee shop reading, trying to not like verbally say things out loud as I'm reading. I'm like, it feels like a church service a little bit where I'm trying to like holler back to the preacher or something as I'm going through this. And so, yeah, just for you and your course of allies in this, I'm deeply, deeply grateful for, just how, and I also want to say for those out there that may be nervous about this being a kind of position as an academic book, it is well researched, is deeply detailed, but is it accessible that if you have an interest in racial equity in the health of cities and neighborhoods, like however you're coming at this, like whether you've read 1,000 books on this, this is your first one, it is accessible to jump in and open up. So if public goods is kind of your starting point, and then it kind of led, you know, pre and post that became the center of the book. Talk a little bit about this, like, what evidence did you see in the unequal distribution of public goods? And then like, how did that then impact kind of the American mindset about lower income communities?
Yeah. So one of the pieces of this story that evolved over time was trying to understand the way that segregation patterns have changed over time on the ground, and then how that has affected our mindset about public goods and deservingness. And the story that I tell in the book is essentially that segregation begins at a very micro level, right? We have one block that tends to be mostly white or tends to be mostly homeowners near a block that is mostly people of color, mostly renters. And over time, those blocks get larger and larger, so that by the Second World War, we really have whole neighborhoods that are populated with predominantly renters, predominantly people of color. And so you start to see the spatial distribution of cities really emerge by about 1945. And that becomes sort of the anchor for a lot of people's mindset about, you know, what's a good neighborhood, what's a bad neighborhood, what's the wrong side of the tracks. You can't really have a wrong side of the tracks when you're talking about segregation block by block. So it's only as segregation grows in spatial scale that we begin to understand in sort of our popular thinking about how cities, what the makeup of our cities is. And then of course, in the 1940s is when we begin to see the rise of suburbanization, and that gets layered on top of this. So while we went from, first we went from block by block segregation to neighborhoods being segregated, and then we start to see whole cities being segregated. Mm-hmm. And it is that process of suburbanization being linked to segregation that helped me to understand this pattern in a sort of more holistic way. The rise of suburbanization is really when you start to see language in the sort of the popular thinking about, we have a right to good schools, we have a right to protect our neighborhood. And so it is, these things are emerging at the same time and reinforcing each other, right? And so the idea that some people are deserving of a good house and a good school and clean water, and other people are not deserving of a nice house and good schools and clean water, sort of happens as the spatial segregation is being built over time. And there's a lot of really excellent writing in sociology and history about the development of the sort of rights revolution, this idea of it's sort of building the meritocracy into the spatial design of cities. And that's where we're at now, right? And so it's very rare that you hear people say explicitly racist or classist things now in the public sphere. They use other kinds of language, right? We want to maintain the character or the community that we have in ways that that language was developed in the 1950s and 1960s and becomes much more prominent in the 1980s and 90s, and it exists today as well.
Yeah, I remember seeing an ad that was used in California that really was tracing, kind of protecting that language you're talking about, the rights of our community. I mean, they were trying to draw this direct, like, patriotic link back to George Washington,
right?
Like, this battle to, quote, protect the character, the rights of our neighborhood is, like, it's patriotic, right? And so, like, I think that's the challenge that we're trying to issue to folks that we have access to speak to say, like, there are definitely places in our history where you will find overtly racist, classist statements. That is very clear, very obvious. But that is such a small sliver on a very wide spectrum of the way that we've designed this racial and economic segregation into our places. And the challenge to like, even if it's not the stated goal, if it's the outcome at the end, right. We've at least got to say, whether on purpose or not, that's where we are. So
that's one of the important parts of understanding that when you build these preferences into the spatial makeup of cities, you essentially have, it creates a scenario where you don't have to have racist or classist sentiment at all in order to be a person mm-hmm. who ends up participating in the maintenance of those divisions. It is mm-hmm. it is probably absolutely 100% true that people view the character of their community deeply, that they want to protect the neighborhood, mm-hmm. the what they see out their front door, and that they don't consciously think of that as a racist mm-hmm. or classist behavior. But it ends up producing the same kinds of patterns as if it were a racist or classist behavior. And that is the effect of embedding these kinds of decisions into the geography of our cities.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like earlier you mentioned like some of this not being as overt in the political science field. I even think like in the disciplines or the movements that are geared towards racial equity, racial justice, you don't often hear, even in those conversations, the language around zoning or city planning or design, where it's like, I'm all for you. I believe in what you're advocating for, but at some level, we got to get back to like, well, we've designed the function of our cities to be this way. And so even if my feelings change or my mindset changes about other people, I'm still, like to your point, I'm still participating in a design that upholds the inequity across our places. So what are some of the policies? Like if it is baked into city design, city planning, zoning, what would you say are some of the things that got us there? If that's kind of the big idea that we've politically designed it, in what ways? Like what have we done that have racially, economically segregated us?
Well, one of the very clear patterns that I've seen it's a little bit in the book, but actually I've continued to do research on this question. Mm-hmm. So what at the micro level produces mm-hmm. these kinds of patterns? And there are, you know, a couple of related choices that cities make about essentially density. So there are a variety of different regulatory tools that cities mm-hmm. use to manage the density of different neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. The single most important predictor of race and class segregation in a city is the degree to which density is also segregated. What I mean by that is if you have some neighborhoods where there are smaller homes, less expensive homes, homes that are more tightly clustered together in one part of town, and you have another part of town where the homes are spread far from each other. They have large lots. They are only single family units that are standalone. Mm-hmm. That is what I mean by regulatory segregation, right? There are types of homes in one part of town that are different from the types of homes in a different part of town. And that is going to underlay segregation along race and class lines, because the affordability of those homes is very different and the preferences for that kind of density tends to be different across race and class lines as well. So there are other tools that cities that have been used in the past to segregate cities. And I'm talking about redlining. I'm talking about racial steering, overt racist and classist behavior that prevent people of color or prevent renters from living in a particular community. Mm. But today we don't have nearly as much of that overt action. What we have is different types of regulatory tools that produce essentially the same kind of outcome.
So you're saying we didn't solve this in the civil rights era. We didn't like we were, you know, racist by design, but by 1968 Fair Housing Act, like, you know, we're good. We've tied it all up. And I think, obviously I'm joking, but I think there is something in that there is an assumption that, we may be fixed at least at like a policy level in the civil rights era. And so now we're just dealing with the legacy and the cleanup of what was built before that versus like people seeing that, like, no, we're still actively building and reinforcing. Right. And I think what your book is saying is like, yeah, we've made some changes, but I think your line was like, it's changed in form, but not in the intent. So like, how are you seeing some of those forms continue to evolve and take new shapes today?
So I think it's a very important point that you've just made, which is that in the 1960s, we do see a variety of different regulatory changes, right? We see a variety of different policy changes that are clearly attempted to address overt practices that generate segregation. The Fair Housing Act is, you know, sort of the biggest here, and we have them at the state level and we have it at the federal level. And today, many more people agree that people of all races and all classes should be permitted to live in all neighborhoods. Whether or not that actually occurs is a separate question. So we have changed. Our views have changed in the United States. People's preferences have changed in the United States. And we do have laws that prevent racial covenants from being enforced. We don't have the federal government explicitly adopting redlining practices any longer. So that's not to say that we haven't made progress. We have. Those things are real change. Mm-hmm. And my work suggests that those kinds of behaviors produce much more dramatic segregation. The problem is, once you get segregation in place, any kind of regulatory structure that prevents change in the current housing stock sticks in place the segregation that was created in prior decades. So we have lots and lots of regulations now that stick in place what existed before. And even if those regulations today, like historic overlays, are not typically, you know, advertised as being sort of racist on their face, and they are not promoted by people who are attempting to create racial segregation, but they stick in place segregation that was created when racism was much more acceptable, right? When you had housing stock that was specifically created for white residents and housing stock that was specifically created for Black residents.
Hey guys, just wanted to take a quick break from this conversation to make an invitation. If you are feeling challenged by these conversations and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. Place-based work is too hard to go at it alone. So whether it's some one-on-one coaching or us walking with you through our 2-year cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you. Please reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
Yeah, I think that's the important, maybe the summons or the challenge to folks to say that like remove your personal, whether or not you have personal bias or not towards living towards people different amongst people who are different from you, like look around into your own neighborhood, look around into your own city and say, if these patterns are there, they're not by accident, and they're not just by personal choice.
That's an important point, is that, and I try to explain this in a variety of different ways in lots of different places in my work. Segregation is the preference of the segregators. It is not the preference of the segregated. People who end up segregated would rather live in neighborhoods that look like the segregator neighborhoods, right? But for various reasons, they are not able to do that. Everybody wants their kids to go to the best school in the city. Everybody wants to live in a crime-free neighborhood. Everybody wants to live in a place where you have sidewalks and you can walk your dog. those things are universal preferences. And the fact that some neighborhoods have access to those things and some neighborhoods do not means that some preferences are not being met in our system.
And the double level of pain in that is that, that the American society has begun, has taken up a view that low-income neighborhoods are the way they are because of the character of low-income people.
That's right.
That we've baked inequality into your neighborhood, and then we blame you for it, right?
Exactly. A great example of this that I give in the book is that in the early period of development of cities, cities could decide which roads to pave and which roads to leave as dirt. It was very common that they would pave the central business community as well as white neighborhoods that were connected to the central business community. Paving works best if you connect the roads to each other. And then would ignore the neighborhoods of color. And in Los Angeles, this is the Latino neighborhoods and the Chinese neighborhood. And very quickly, the newspaper begins to report about the dirty people who live in the neighborhoods with unpaved roads. Of course, the fact that the roads are unpaved is not the fault of the people who live in the unpaved neighborhood, but it is dirtier. And it's harder to live there. And you, when it rains, it's muddy and disgusting. And so that the choices that are made by government can reinforce stereotypes and beliefs about the people who live in a particular neighborhood through no fault of their own.
Yeah. And to get away from this idea of just they chose to live here, we choose to live here instead is, and again, and I think that's the power of this is to, the scale between something that's benign and malignant, or even this, the scale of something that's purposefully good versus something purposefully harmful. There's a million steps between those poles, right? And to invite us to take an honest look at the whatever city you're in, whatever neighborhood you're in, to ask kind of what why is it this way?
Right? How did we get here?
Yeah, and you make the statement that our neighborhoods are getting more integrated, but cities are getting more segregated. So what does that mean? And why is that so? Why is that the case?
So segregation between neighborhoods peaked in the 1970s throughout the United States. So that was when in the 1970s, we were as segregated as we would ever be neighborhood to neighborhood. And of course, that is when suburbanization is really taking off. So as segregation between neighborhoods is peaking, the population begins to move to the outer lying edges of both cities and then to suburban communities. And suburbs begin incorporating at a much greater rate during this time period. So in the 1980s, we start to see the dramatic rise of segregation between cities. And we really haven't changed that much. So we have become a little bit more segregated between cities, but mostly it's just been kind of sticky. Segregation between neighborhoods has continued to decrease. Mostly, this is driven by the fact that Black residents now live in neighborhoods that are more likely to be populated with Latino and Asian American residents in addition to Black residents. White neighborhoods continue to be the most segregated kind of neighborhood across the United States. So a little bit, this is, you know, there's a complicated set of patterns that are going on all the time. Segregation is an aggregate measure. It tells you how the city looks as a whole or the metropolitan area looks as a whole. But what's happening at the micro level, at the neighborhood level, can be highly variable to produce those aggregate patterns.
Yes. Oh, man. I think my colleagues at FCS would be standing on our chairs cheering at that, because I think that's where we even see as we ended up having to design basically our own neighborhood health measurement process and set of tools, because what's been available to us at census or zip code level, even like getting smaller than city level, being able to say the data available would tell me such a very different story about the neighborhood we're partnering with if that's what I listen to, like whether it be from income, you know, employment rates, education rates, like it all be radically different from this actual neighborhood. And to be able to say, okay, maybe Atlanta as a whole is doing really well on these 1, 2, 3 measures. But man, if you get down at neighborhood level, it's almost of like the overabundance of privilege or growth in certain areas is kind of pulling up the aggregate numbers.
That's right.
Where over here, it's like, it's getting worse over here, you know, while you're celebrating some of these bigger numbers.
And getting sub city data on any metric is really challenging. And, you know, this is the bane of all local politics scholars' existence, right? Is that what I want is a map of sewers at the neighborhood level. I want to know which sewers have overflowed. I want to know which libraries have been refurbished. And really what I have is a number that says, here's the amount of money we've spent on sewers or libraries in the city as a whole.
Yeah. Wow. And I think, and that's one of the ones where I would, you know, think like, on purpose or not, that even that approach is another way by which we're, to your point, sticking in place these patterns, right? That if the historic pattern has been laid, you know, it's the groundwork, and we're not doing anything intentionally to undo that, even that way of measuring how many dollars we spent across the city is another way of just saying, hey, we're going to treat all things as if every neighborhood is equal, and
right.
And they're not, right? What do you see as like, well, so we've been kind of talking neighborhood level, city level, what is this doing to us as a nation, right? That, which is an important, reminder for me, because we can be so hyper neighborhood centric in our thinking and our work and our teaching, that the aggregate of all these neighborhoods across the U.S., this has an influence on our culture as a nation. What are you seeing as the impact of this more broadly on us?
I'm working on some new work answering that question. So I don't have all the answers yet, but I can say that one of the pieces of the answer here is that sticking in place our demographic makeup also creates the reservoir for polarization. It creates a reservoir for political polarization at the national level, but it also creates reservoirs of polarization at the local level. And it allows us to imagine that we are more different from each other than we might otherwise be. And it creates an incentive, a political incentive to make dividing lines that are overlapping with neighborhood lines and city lines rather than other kinds of division, right? If you have a whole neighborhood that is opposed to teaching CRT in schools and a whole neighborhood that is supportive of teaching CRT in schools, that's a very different fight than if you have people who are intermingled with each other. So one of the outcomes of this kind of pattern is that it offers the opportunity for polarization to deepen along lots of different lines.
And it's interesting, even like as you think about that, it makes me think about the way that our language is even like red city, blue city, you know, red district, whatever. And it's like, are there any purple places out there to where we're in? And I think consuming any version of news, like we all know that we're polarized, right? And we can place the blame at certain figureheads or certain people or whatever, but even to think about like national polarization at the granular level, it is like neighborhood level segregation, like is part of what's setting that up. And like, if I'm looking at my front door and all the people around me are going to pretty much agree with me on everything, then it's really easy to villainize.
That's right.
Those that don't see the obvious things that are, of course, these things are true. And we don't have a chance for that discourse. That's really fascinating. What do you see as kind of the, if we don't work actively to undo this and to kind of build better or different patterns, like what's the next iteration of this? Like, again, you talk about it may be changing in form over time, but the intent seems to is staying the same. Like, what are some of the forms we might see in the next couple of decades in our cities and neighborhoods if we don't make substantive changes?
Well, one of the things that is true that is, you know, exogenous to what's happening in cities is that our income inequality in the United States has increased quite dramatically over the last 50 years. And as income inequality increases and we continue to create the opportunity or allow neighborhoods to wall themselves off, we can deepen the effects of those inequalities quite dramatically. And sometimes people ask me, is it better to be segregated within a city or across cities, right? Is there one, is there one type that's better? And obviously all types of segregation are problematic in my view, but segregation within a city is actually something that is you can resolve politically, because you have neighborhoods that are different from each other, but the tax pool all goes to the center of the city and then can get redistributed throughout the city, right? So every neighborhood can benefit from better sewer lines, from that pot of tax dollars. Now, whether or not that's politically feasible is a different question, but it's possible. If you have tax dollars divided across city lines, the suburbs have vastly higher, you know, have vastly larger pools of money to spend than your center cities do, then that is not resolvable through politics. The outer lying areas may have wonderful sewers, and the center city may always have poor sewers. And no matter how many dollars are raised by those respective communities, it can never be redistributed. And so the fact that we are now more segregated across geographic lines, across municipal lines, in my view, has the potential to perpetuate public goods inequalities in a much more dramatic way over the next 50 years. So if I had to pick, I would rather see segregation within cities than segregation between cities or segregation between metropolitan areas.
Because at least our destinies are intertwined at some level, right?
Right.
that is that if we're bound by some of the same boundaries, I guess you could say that at least at that level, I have a forced interest in the good of my somewhat distant neighbor because we're going to be influenced by these things together. That's interesting. What can we do to undo this? Like, I think at some level it can feel like as soon as you mention like city planning or zoning or whatever, like I think vast majority of the American public is like,
I'm out.
I don't do that. I don't know what that is. I don't know how you change all of that. Like I can vote in a local election, but maybe I can go to a community meeting. But beyond that, like it feels so baked in.
Here's the simplest thing that every neighborhood can do. Every neighborhood can advocate to have all types of housing in their neighborhood. If on your street you have little houses and big houses and attached houses and detached houses, you're on the right path. If you are willing to have a three-story, 10-unit building built next door to you, you're on the right path. The more we can create spaces where all different kinds of people are encouraged to share the same physical space, the more opportunity we will have to overcome both these reservoirs of antagonism as well as integration along all of these different lines.
And how do you advocate? Earlier you mentioned that the segregator is happy with the way things are, and if you're the segregated, you're not. So that vision that you described, I think, appeals to the segregated. And appeals to probably the types like you and me who are in this work trying to advocate for those types of changes. But for the deliberate or not, if you're the segregator, if you're the one who's been benefiting from this division, whether you wanted it that way or not, you know, we can leave that to the side. Like, how do you tell that person it's worth it to you? Right.
I think in different communities, different language can be mobilizing and can be coalition building. There can be some communities that are motivated by the environmental degradation that sprawl creates. There are some communities that can be motivated by the idea that their grandchildren or even them as elderly people will not have a place in a community because there's not the right kind of housing. There are some people that are motivated by the idea that we should allow our teachers and our firefighters and our dishwashers to be our next door neighbors if we're going to be, if we're going to create the right fabric of our community. But at the end of the day, there are some people who will never be compelled by any of these arguments. And the only way to produce change is to create a coalition that is big enough and strong enough to force their vision. That can happen at the city level, but as I've suggested, there's only so far you can go within a city to force outerlying areas to participate in this conversation. Then the only option is to move it up to a higher level of government. There are states that are making big moves on this front. Mm-hmm. California is sort of at the forefront of this, sort of compelling suburban communities to develop more housing and to integrate their housing types in different ways. Mm-hmm. But it's hard, and it's been a long, decades long struggle to produce these kinds of outcomes. Historically, state courts have been very supportive of local control and the right to defend and protect a community. So, you know, the answer is very slow going. We have seen change, though, and there are remedies. So California's builder's remedy is something that is being used in full force right now. That is a situation where if a city is preventing development from occurring that the state believes is the right kind of development for that community, developers can actually get the state on their side and force the community to allow them to build whatever it is that they're trying to build. But that is using the muscle of the state in a way that many states are not, they're not willing to do.
Yeah. And I think the length of the battle is important to pay attention to. Like we're, you know, the side of FCS that I work on is the training consulting side. So we're trying to take practices learned in 45 years of work and sharing that with other local practitioners. And I think one of our challenges in that battle is just the scope or the time frame that people need to be comfortable with, that that 2 years is like you're just doing your pre-workout stretch. Right? You're like, it's really like we're saying, like, think in 50-year time spans, not in 2 year kind of sprints or whatnot. And that this is, to your point, if we've baked this in since the 1890s, is like urbanization is really beginning to start in the U.S. That like that we're going to undo this, even in the rest of my own lifetime is unreasonable. And so, but in all of that is the challenge of staying hopeful,
right?
Staying motivated, of keeping your kind of hands in it. So for you, like what are some like signs of hope that you see, whether it's movements or leaders or people or things or decisions? Like, what do you look at to say, okay, all of this research, all this writing, all this advocating is not in vain. Like a difference is being made. Like we can move this over time. Like, so yeah, for you, what's the, what's the hopeful thing?
There are communities that are making choices to densify, and particularly along transit lines. There are, you know, we do see change in various places. Minneapolis sort of ended their ban on multifamily housing, and that alone didn't do much, but they made a number of additional changes, like changing parking minimums and other kinds of densification measures that really have started to improve housing starts in the city. And so you can, you know, as a social scientist, I'm happy with any little measure. So, you know, permits being pulled for development that's going to happen in 10 years, that's a start, right? That is, movement in the right direction, or even just changing the laws on the books. So a lot of places across the United States have started to allow backyard dwelling units, accessory dwelling units. They're called different things in different places. Mm-hmm. That's not going to fix our housing crisis, but it's a start. It's allowing people to think outside the box of their detached single family home. You know, part of this is sort of rolling back the Leave It to Beaver vision of what our communities should look like. And it's going to take time. And so, you know, I'm happy with little change on the margins, I guess, is the answer to your question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I love that. And I think, like, to your point of, like, the vision that we have for our communities, I think that's where, as much as it's important to get into tactics and how-tos, I think there's some level of what we're working for is just, what does our imagination say to us about what a vibrant neighborhood life looks like?
That's right.
Right. And because I think, I mean, for the majority of the first half of my life, like interstates, single family neighborhoods, like all of this was just like, it wasn't good or bad. Like this is just not just the way it is, but it's like, Wait, should, like, this is all normal.
This is the way,
like,
it has to be, or the way normal. It is. It's normal,
Versus being like, no, we all made choices to do it this way, and it could have been done 1,000 other ways.
Right.
And maybe the bad news is we designed it this way, but the good news is, like, people designed it this way, so people can design it in a different way. And I think to the challenger notion, right? To say like, what have I accepted as normal or as good that is less than what could be for me and for my children, for my family, for my neighborhood, and to begin to really examine, critique, pull apart our sense of what a healthy neighborhood is, and to say there might be something really rich and rewarding for all of us, right? Not just the people who've been cut out now being included, but actually we could all be better off if there's a different, maybe a different way.
Sometimes I make progress by asking people if they would like to have a coffee shop on their corner. And a lot of people would like to have a coffee shop on their corner. Yeah. That sounds nice, right? And like, again, they're little steps, right? To getting people to change their imagination of what a healthy community looks like.
Well, I believe your book is doing that work as well as your other research and work. I'm super excited to advocate for your work, your research, this book. It's been meaningful to me. It's been meaningful to my team as we've unpacked it and dialogued about it as well. So again, thank you for the work that you're doing first and foremost, but also thank you for your time today just to sit in with me and join me in this conversation. And I look forward to following you and following the good work that you continue to do.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
If you have benefited from this conversation and want to dig in more deeply to understand the mechanisms of our segregation, I would encourage you to pick up Segregation by Design, Local Politics and Inequality in American Cities, wherever books are sold. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.